And all at once it turned and went the other way. And they said, that's fine. Shut her off. My rudders was not doing anything at all. But we'd come around, missed a big sweeper, missed the big roots and it was in the river, and it made this figure S and landed in kind of a little lagoon on the edge of a gravel bank, and here's a big old tree that had been washed down and it was roots anchored in there, and they tied the barge up to it. Now when things like that happen, you know, and you can't see what's happening, and the motor shut off at that time. Then I turned the key off, but everything was planned. You can't help but think that there's some, you see what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you don't tell people about this because they say, oh, you're too far out or something.
Have you ever had the same sort of experience to a sense of adversity and then out of the adversity an awareness of being channeled in slightly a different direction that would never have been you'd never have been aware of if it hadn't happened?
Well, I think that that shows the difference between paying attention to the guidance or trying to leave your life all by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Difficulties are usually difficulties that you bring on yourself in one form or another, or something that is within your ability to straighten out right on the start, but you misunderstand perhaps. I know that happens all the time. It's like somebody saying something to you and you misinterpret what they say. And maybe it goes on and something is not done or something done that shouldn't have been. It's hard to put the finger on any one particular incident, but I know it happens probably daily, and in some people, why, it's a pretty near tragedy. But I think this guidance that is available to everybody, I like to look at it from a stand like Marcus Baugh. I don't know whether you know him or not, but he's a great theology a writer and a researcher. He has studied all over the world, different religions. Trained also as a psychologist and psychiatrist. But a good writer too. He is able to explain better than most people, most writers. But his, I think, idea is that is legitimate. That you have the opportunity to keep from having any incidents that is going to interfere in any way or cause mishap, difficulties. But you have to be very much aware all the time of teachings of Supreme Being.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Supreme Being is not just God as we refer to him, or Jesus, or Son, or Allah, or various other ones. It's just they're all connected within your knowledge to understand, if you want to. But the choice is a free choice. I like that approach.
Yeah, I can go along with that.
So it's a fascinating, really fascinating subject. We've had so many instances of where difficulties have been avoided. And I recall one time that would emphasize a need for study and so on, being open, not have to pay too much attention to what somebody's written in the manual, of wanting to go up the river. And I forget why it was that we had to go up. It would have been better, perhaps, if we had waited a few days. Maybe it was because the water was low, or maybe it was high, I forget. Or it might have been the condition of the motor. But you get stubborn, and you go anyway. You're going on your own. You're not going to get the help. And I remember I got about halfway up to where I was going in the evening, and the motor conked out. Unrepairable. It was a magneto that just burnt up. Well, what are you going to do? Here you are halfway, and the work that I wanted to accomplish would have been to use the motor with the power coming back with the load. And it was, come to think of it, was a contract for power poles for the Army. Mm-hmm. And they were long poles, and the motor would do the job, tow them. So you get bullheaded. Well, if I went back to town, I would have not met my commitments by being up there and so on at the proper time. And if I'd continue on up, why, what am I going to do? I have no power to come back down. Dilemma. Foolish. I had better have waited another day and seen that the motor was right. Didn't do it. Yet I had a feeling of maybe a guidance, or maybe it was just a hunch that people talk about so often. Don't go today, wait till tomorrow's late in the day anyway. So I pulled the boat on up. I got up there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the next day, why, instead of bringing a load down, why, I ended up by walking down and getting parts and then walking back. And that meant coming up the highway and going for miles and through the chin. That's a little more than 9 miles. And miserable, you know. Rain and niggerheads to crawl over and ponds to go through. And how foolish it is, you see. Well, nobody was really hurt, but it's a waste of time, and it caused confusion to your workmen, and didn't accomplish anything. In fact, I was a day late in getting the darn logs down there and up on the bank for the contract, but they didn't penalize me on it. But it's those kind of things. And this can happen many, many times, you know. You want to do something, or somebody talk you into doing something, stop and think it out and say, ask for guidance on it. Mm-hmm. And it usually will. Now that can apply to health or finances or anything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's really, I tell you an instance that would apply to me. Mm-hmm. And why there's really not much to add. I was going into Pioneers number, that's been quite a few years ago. And one of the men in the Pioneers who was reviewing qualifications and applications had, there were three of them on that board, and the one in charge who at that time that he told us about it, Betty and I here, well, happened to be president of the organization. I won't mention his name. But he's pretty nice time. Him and his wife was out and had a cup of tea. And he says, you know, funny thing, here you've been here a lot more years than I have, yet I brought you into the Pioneers. Funny, isn't it? But he says, that reminds me of a funny little thing. I was on a reviewing committee when your application came in for membership. And you had on there, retired. And I said, retired? He's never done anything to retire from. He says, how come you put that on there, retired? And I think that more or less sums up what's happened here to me in philosophy. I have never done anything to retire from. Betty got a big kick out of it. You're busy all the time, but you're not doing anything, yeah. You know.
You said somebody told me you told me you had a band, or you started an orchestra. What was all
that? Oh, yeah, well, they had an orchestra here one time, and that was in the early 30s. And then somebody came in from the States, and I forget who it was now or the circumstances, but they wanted to compete, and they had brought their own little 3 or 4 piece band in, and they were going to cut prices and everything, and at least once or twice a week was, that was about all there was to do here. Nobody had much money, you know. During Depression, why, everybody just tried to be happy.
So
have as much fun as possible.
Dance band, yeah.
Yeah. So, there was quite a bit of confusion about this little layout, wanting to take over all the business. And there was two or three feel-good musicians here, a wonderful drummer, all these real out of this world. And he kind of resented them coming in and wanting to cut prices and just take over just to keep alive. And he was talking with me about it and said, well, why don't you put out better music? That's all I have to do. Yeah, but you can't get people to get it. And I said, let's try it. So I talked with a few good musicians. Charlotte Ames was just wanted to break into that sort of business on piano. You know, heard of her.
Yeah.
She's still playing on. And Rose Manuela, the teacher, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
Her brother was going to college out there, and he played the slip horn, travel trombone. Billy Stroker,
mm-hmm.
First National Bank,
yeah.
he tutored a trumpet. Oh, a few people like that. Mm-hmm. And the college kids, they didn't have the money to play with either, you know. They didn't have to walk to work, but they close to it.
Mm-hmm.
Times are tough for a lot of them.
That was in the 30s.
Yeah. So we went ahead and just ended up with about an 11-piece band, and and we tried to put out music that you couldn't help but dance. And it got involved, and pretty soon it ended up with 3 or 4 years that way. And then, I don't know, we also started the original Sourdough Dance Club downtown. And
mm-hmm.
I played fiddle in that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was, to me, it was a lot of fun. But the kids all appreciate it. I say kids, they're grown people, because they didn't have this extra little money to play with, and $10 or $15 a week was quite a lot of money in those days.
Still is.
Yeah, still is, yeah.
I mean, to have it for your own to play with, yeah.
So that was more or less the way it got started, and we kept interested. Buddy was at a homemakers meeting a couple of years, three years ago, I guess it was, and there was one of our local clubs, I forget what they call it now, but they had a guest once a week would come in and give a little talk. One of them happened to be Mrs. Ed Clausen. And I knew her husband real well, and I had met her, you know, how do you do? But the elder family, one of her sons is runs a clothing store there by the old fire hall on Cushman.
Oh, I know one you mean. Yeah.
Cy Clausen is his name. Real fine chap. That his mother was giving a talk, and she was telling about the early days in Alaska, and she said, and not only, oh, they said they had an orchestra here, and went on and on and on, but she said, when they started, you had to get up and dance. She says, it was just a rhythm that you had to dance, and she says, not only that, they weren't wearing sweaters, but they'd have tuxedos on, and so forth and so on, and I don't know whether Betty tipped her. They were talking about us. They said it was all the old buzz within these millionaires, Nighthawks. We had several different names that went by over the years, you know. But I couldn't help but laugh. And then I happened to think of looking down there, and she was rather a short person and rather not fat, but I mean she's plump. And many a time I remember in at least once a week or so, I see them go by, and they'd always be as happy looking. Well, that was the reason for doing it.
What better reason? I mean, what better reason?
Yeah, filled in the time. And there was always so much going on, the benefits for this or that. St. Joe's Hospital was always open for help.
Mm-hmm.
We put on a Hosey Ross, who was the undertaker, and he was also a Hartford insurance agent here in Fairbanks for many times. One time a tourney, and one time a drunken horse stage operator to Esther.
Mm-hmm.
And he quit whiskey and when he done that, everybody thought, my God, but stay away from him, you know. It was an attitude, ex-drunk, he'll try to implant you. But he wasn't that way. He ended up a millionaire, very fine chap, excellent. I talked with him when he went out on his last trip up. We had talked for about an hour in the National Airport of old times. Wonderful person. But funny how you lose the train of thought.
Oh, yeah, that happens to me all the time, though.
But anyway, he and my older brother and a boy by the name of Roden Davis and myself, but Hosey Ross was a spark plug, because he was on the city council at that time, or on the school board at that time, and decided that the kids had to have a area they could play basketball. Nobody had any money. No, couldn't get a dime out of the council. So we decided to put on a benefit show. And they got a bunch of old-time plays and worked them up, skits, you know. Done, Bernie Stone, the editor, the Newsmiler, done the advertising for free. And come time for the program, and everybody turned out because it was a benefit deal for raising money to build a gymnasium. And in the meantime, why, Hosey on his own, by his own resources, went ahead and started in buying local lumber and getting carpenters and so forth, and it was approved by the rest of us. But he went, so he had the money, you know, and he would contract to have the work done, and it wasn't a short while until the darn building was up. So we put on this play to pay off the indebtedness, materials, and labor. Well, everybody turned out, and one of the acts, and you probably have seen it, was where you have a table with a hole in the top there, and you get a dark-haired person and underneath, and light-haired one over here with stiff collars on, and you have a big old saber and dress up. And brother was about 250 pounds then, and we dressed him up with a towel around his head and a bad big flowing curtain or something around him, and he was going to execute some fancy stuff, you know. So he cut the head off of the blonde boy and carried it under a napkin over and set it down over the hole on the other end of the table, and up comes a dark-haired boy, head up to the hole. Well, after he got done with that, he was supposed to reach down there and grab the curtain that we had around the big table and expose the trick. Well, he had a hold of us of his own sash when he got around there and walked on off the stage. And here's nothing. People wondered what it was about, and they were so astounded, and everything was so silent, that we got to thinking, maybe this would go over a second time. So we put it on again, and we made more money the next day. A real good chap of ours, a friend of ours, an elderly man, had his whole family there. And I remember seeing him come in, because Roy Hiles, you know. And if ever you see him, no matter where you see him, anywhere in Alaska. And here, the second night, they're sitting right down front, right in the very front row with all the little kids. We pulled the trick, but this time he made sure that he got a hold of the curtain, so he exposed the trick. And he said, he came to me after the show. He said, you know, that was a good trick. But he says, I seen it last night, and I knew it was a fake. He knew.
But he came back to
the show. Yeah. But these kind of little incidents.
Oh, yeah.
We had another one that was, I darn near got killed the second night on that, too. It's Roden Davis, one of the four, just the four of us is all, plus people, music, you know, and mm-hmm. singing and things like that. But was a big, broad man with a turtleneck sweater on and a slouch cap, and he looked like a typical thug. So Hosey, everything was so simple, no money attached to it. See, and we had a little table there on the stage, and Hosey sitting down there, the curtain opens. He says, I am getting so tired of the book agents. You've probably seen that a dozen times over the years. And book agents come in, I just don't have time, and I'll get a hold of somebody and see if we can't arrange. So he called up on the phone and short while, I hear come Roden Davis, and he looks horrible. Well, I had a board, and I had it all in the back of my pants fixed so I wouldn't get hurt, and I had a 1x4, and I had it cut here and there so that you whack with it once and the darn thing would break. Well, it worked out fine the first night. Somebody substituted a 2x4 for that 1x4 the second night, and I was a book agent. And
boy, I mean, that's awful.
And I came in there and I tried to sell Hosey a book, and he had it planned that shoot him, and he gave him a cap pistol, you know, a pistol with a cap in it. And when he shot, well, I had something reached up and took it, a little pebble or something, and I threw it out in the audience and coughed like that and threw the pebble out. And so then he got a cannon, stovepipe, you know, and a little powder and a lot of smoke when you touch it off, and he wheeled that up there, and I kept on talking, and he shot that, and I had a billiard ball in my pocket. And I reached like that, and I threw it out and rolled down in the audience. Never got it back either, part of the equipment. And so that didn't work. I kept on talking. Then I was supposed to beat him to death, and he darn near done it. I tried to get him to stop, and the crowd was laughing, and Hosey couldn't hear my protest, but he says, "I did see tears in your eyes." Oh, my God, I couldn't walk for a week. So I paid dearly for that mistake.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But he tried to break. He was supposed to break the one before, and he tried awful hard. My God, he's about a 250-pound man.
Holy smoke, that's
just
terrible.
Still feel that, you know.
Oh,
all little things like that. But it filled in the time, and made it interesting and not just bearable, but kind of enjoyment.
Because at the same time you were raising vegetables and just keeping alive and doing.
Oh no, we didn't start this vegetable. Now in the early days we did have a garden, on the old ranch down there. We had done real well, you know. We had stock and of all kinds, and always a lot of horses and animals. And
well, why? Where did you